Welcome to the UFO Files. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting direct from Las Vegas at the Sunset Station Hotel and Casino, where the Crash Retrieval Conference is going on. It's been going on for a while here, dealing with UFO crashes and reports over the years. Lots of interesting things coming out on the crash retrieval situation that we'll probably try to get into a little bit. Stanton Friedman is our guest this hour. He'll be along here in a few minutes. Stanton, of course, well-known for the MJ-12 documents and his book on the subject, and one of the top-notch researchers in the field of UFO crashes. So it promises to be a very, very interesting program. I guess it's been about 25 years since Stanton started his investigation into the whole situation. And it's an interesting thing, and Stanton told me one time about how he got into that. And actually, it didn't happen in Roswell, New Mexico originally. He ran across Jesse Marcel there in Louisiana, of all places. I went to Roswell, started researching it. Came up with, the reputation of being one of the top experts of the Roswell crash and what happened and what didn't happen. And then he kind of explored some of the other things that were involved as well. Really, I think you'll enjoy the conversation that we'll have with Stanton here in a moment. Now, the MJ-12 documents have been really a big subject for some time, and a lot of people have been wondering about whether or not they're real. Lots of different kinds of copies around. Stanton's been on documentaries, he's been on TV programs, has a book or two. Some people have really gone after Stanton and tried to attack him on his MJ-12 stories. Unfortunately, the critics almost always follow the four basic rules of debunkers, and we'll have Stanton get into that in the interview, because not only is it clever, but it also makes a lot of sense. So stand by. We're going to be talking to Stanton Friedman here in a moment as we get ready for our show. Hope you stay tuned. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin, and this, of course, is our broadcast from Las Vegas on the UFO Files.
Internationally acclaimed private eye Joe Culligan has a new book or video that may answer these questions. How much alimony does he pay? How much child support does he pay? Did he really graduate from college? What assets does he own? Does his divorce file say he beat his wife? Is he all he claims to be? Has he ever been arrested? Does he have a history of drunken driving? And much, much more. Before you agree to marry anybody, before you take on a new business partner, before you begin any serious relationship, don't put yourself in danger. Order P.I. Joe Culligan's When in Doubt, Check Him Out. The book or video is just $19.95 plus postage. Ship anywhere you wish. To anyone you care about. We'll ship confidentially. To order by credit card, call now 1-800-921-9898. That's 1-800-921-9898. Specify the book, the video, or both. Don't risk your business or your life. Call 1-800-921-9898 now.
And we have Stanton Friedman, who's a legend and in UFO land for sure. Stanton, I heard some great things about your trip to Table Rock on Thursday.
That was fun. I enjoyed myself.
And you, of course, will be speaking here at this conference as well. And this conference really is probably pretty dear to your heart simply because of the subject matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been working on crash flying saucers, or working about them. I haven't been on any crash flying saucers for more than 25 years. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm giving the same, well, the same title for the talk. And Table Rock, New Attacks on Roswell and MJ-12. And I'm doing that here. But I had 2 hours to speak there, and I only have 45 minutes here. So I'm going to be talking very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can cover some of the things that you're not going to be able to cover here, too. I know that we have talked about this in the past, and your book is just incredible. And before we go any further, let's talk about your latest project. So you got a new book out or anything?
I don't have a new book out. I've got one outline. I've got a couple chapters done, Flying Saucers and Science. And I'll try to, I've done about 75 papers on UFOs over the years, a lot of MUFON conference papers and little articles and stuff. And the idea is to update the papers, because I cover a lot of subjects that nobody else really covers. Travel to the stars from somebody who's worked on fission and fusion rockets and stuff like that.
I like that already.
Well, I'm pointing out the errors in the way of those astronomers who think that they can say it's impossible, when we have a past history of their saying that's impossible about things that we now know are possible. For example, a great astronomer in 1903, October, just over 100 years ago, published an article in which he considered the future of flight. The only way man would ever fly, he said, would be with the help of a balloon, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And when he found out about that, he said, well, maybe a pilot, but certainly they'll never carry any passengers. 20 years later, another great astronomer, Dr. Bickerton, proved that it would be impossible to give anything sufficient energy to get it into orbit around the Earth. He said, look, here's our finest explosive. Here's the amount of energy it takes per pound of stuff that you want to put in orbit when it's moving 18,000 miles an hour. Here's the amount of energy per pound of explosive. It's short by a factor of 10. He made two bad mistakes. One, they're better, more dense energy content of rocket propellants, the right ones, than an explosive, which are rather messy, obviously, if you want to build a rocket with them. And secondly, you don't want to put the rocket fuel in orbit. You want to put the payload in it. What he showed was it would take 10 pounds of propellant to put 1 pound of payload in orbit. My favorite, though, because I live in Canada, I'm a dual citizen, I complain about both governments pretty equally. Dr. Campbell in 1941 was tired of all this science fiction crap about taking a man to the moon. He was going to show that that was nonsense. Published a long scientific paper trying to figure out what would be the required initial launch weight of a chemical rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Now, that's a legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? And pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1 million tons. Now, fast forward 30 years, less than 30 years, and we get three guys to the moon and back. Initial launch weight of the rocket was all of 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. So when astronomers do calculations about space travel, they are almost invariably astronomically in error. Why? Not that they're stupid. It's because it's something about which they are ignorant. They don't know about aeronautics, astronautics, that kind of thing. Incidentally, some of the silly assumptions he made were that you'd use a single-stage rocket. Of course, we don't use single-stage rockets. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration, and our astronauts have to take several G's. As a matter of fact, I was just over at the display of the Liberty 7 spacecraft, which was recovered from the bottom of the ocean. That was one Gus Grissom was in. They got him out, but the spacecraft went down, you know. And there's information at that same facility, Science Center up in Kansas City, that one of the astronauts in testing work had taken 16 G's, and another one had taken 20 G's, and Dr. Campbell assumed a limit of 1 G. He also assumed something that a lot of people don't think about, that the rocket has to provide all the energy for the trip, but we use cosmic freeloading. I don't know if anybody's heard of cosmic freeloading, but
Let's talk about that for a minute. I like the term.
Well, when we launch, there's several things you note. One, we launch from near the equator, Cape Canaveral. We try to get about as far south as you can get. And we launch to the east. Why? Because the Earth rotates at about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. That's a freebie. Second freebie is we launch it so that if the moon didn't come along, it would come right back. Fortunately, the moon's rather regular in its path around the Earth. Why not let its gravitational field pull you in? Why should you provide the energy? Third, when we come back, Dr. Campbell assumed you had to fire a retro rocket. But every pound of propellant you use at the end had to be launched from the Earth at the beginning, slowed down at the moon, takes propellant to do it each step of the way, launched from the moon and slowed down back here. What do? We say, thank you, God, for giving us an atmosphere, gives us something to breathe, and we can slow down the rocket by being smart instead of powerful. Apollo 13, the story, you know, you come in at the correct angle. If you miss that, you either dig a hole in the ground or you miss the planet. So you put all these things together and you say that the people who say you can't get here from there don't know what they're talking about. It's like saying, how can you have a powerful computer on your desk? Look at these vacuum tubes. Look how much energy they produce. Sorry, we're not using vacuum tubes anymore.
I think I get your point about the whole thing, Stanton. You have a wonderful knack of breaking it down so we can all understand it.
I hope so. I mean, my feeling is I'm trying to reach the world. I'm not trying to preach to the converted, and I'm not trying to impress people with esoteric phraseology. And I used some examples in my lecture the other day of the fancy phraseology that the noisy negativists use, and it's funny. Because instead of investigating, they're proclaiming. You got to deal with the world as it is. And I put out, there's four basic rules for debunkers, those who practice debunkery. It's not my term, but I like it. One is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Two, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. Three, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's a lot easier. Those people are all kooks and quacks and, you know. And four, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too darn much trouble. And I get people saying, well, how come there aren't any sightings by professional people? And I say, why do you say that? How much effort have you made to find them? All the surveys show that 5 to 10% of professional people have seen a UFO. That doesn't mean they're broadcasting it, which is another story, of course. Hard to get them to go on your show to talk about what they have seen. So I feel that there is no point in my being an apologist ufologist. Tell it like it is, and you'll get people's respect. And the big thing is you encourage people to open their minds and open their mouths, too. I check all my audiences at the end of my lecture. Typically 10% have seen one, but only 1% have reported what they have seen. Biggest reason, they're fearful of ridicule. I want to let them know it's okay. You don't need to worry about ridicule. If you stick to the facts, talk to the right people like me. I'm not going to laugh at anybody. And that's a big thing. But I personally believe if any major newspaper, doesn't have to be the Washington Post or New York Times, made a sincere effort to elicit reports of former military people that took place while they were in the military, and said they'd protect witness identity and all this kind of thing, give them anonymity, whatever. And here's a number to call, a toll-free number, and here's an email address, and whatever. I think they'd be swamped with reports. And I like military cases because guys on duty very rarely lie about their official activities. I'm not talking about drugs. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about what they're doing when they're monitoring a radar set or something.
I understand.
There's a difference.
And you got a point there.
Well, yeah, you talk to military people, and you got everything to lose. If the boss catches you lying about being on guard duty or that kind of stuff, you know, you're in trouble. And I find so many good reports. Because what I do is not only ask how many of you have seen one and then how many have reported it. Is anybody left? I'll ask how many of you were in the military at the time. If there's still anybody, I'll say you want to tell us about it. And I get some great stories. For example, a guy says, they took my pictures. I'm waiting for the rest of the story, and he's sitting there in the audience.
I'm waiting for that one, too.
Yeah, and so I say, look, you don't need to stand up. I'm not asking your name, but I'm sure everybody would like to hear about it. Everybody claps. So, reluctantly, well, I was flying a four-engine aircraft for the Air Force out over the Pacific. There was another plane 20 miles ahead of us. It radioed back that there was a saucer heading our way. We had gun cameras. We took pictures. We radioed the base we were going to. This is all standard operating procedure. When we landed, the film was taken. Pilots don't take film to the drugstore. It goes through the proper authorities. And we were debriefed and told never to say anything. I had another guy who told me, he said, I'll tell you privately. He was piloting a helicopter in Vietnam. Flying saucer zips around the helicopter, scares the bejeebers out of them because they thought it was a new Russian vehicle. It was back in the 60s. And they're going to be obliterated any moment now. You know, it's a very sleek kind of thing, comparison to a helicopter, almost anything is, I guess. And it went off, left them alone. So naturally, he reported it. You're supposed to report any new technology in battle because everybody would like to know that there's a new weapon system there. And so the next day, the commander of the unit comes over and says, Lieutenant Jones, you didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? Yes, sir, I reported it. You didn't hear me, Lieutenant Jones. You didn't see anything strange yesterday. Well, do you like flying, Lieutenant Jones? Yes, sir. You didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? No, sir. Well, you get enough variations on this theme and a picture begins to come out. So that's why I say appeal to the military people. And I'm still looking, well, I had two stories today here about possible witnesses about Roswell.
Still, even now, all this time later.
Even now, all this time later. Well, to illustrate why I'm an optimist about finding more, last week it was announced that the oldest surviving World War I veteran in Nova Scotia had died. He was 106 years old. World War I now. And there are still 10 left in the country of Canada out of 30 million people. So if we still have World War I veterans, which ended in 1918 after all, then probably there are still a lot of people around who know about 1947. You know, that's not too big a stretch. People are living longer these days. And I'm hoping that some of them will take the attitude that one of the important witnesses about Roswell was then Colonel, later retired Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was chief of staff to General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas, and the 509th at Roswell, the military group there, reported to General Ramey. Now, he told me that he took the call from General Ramey's boss telling him three things, three orders. He said, I want you to get the press off our back today. This is July 8th, 1947. I don't care how you do it, but get them off our back. Two, I want you to send some of the wreckage that's due to be there shortly here with one of your colonel couriers today. General McMullen was in Washington. Dubose was in Fort Worth, Texas.
So you said a colonel as a courier.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't playing games about this. And the third order was, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order, Colonel. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. People sometimes look at me when I say that. I said, you know, this is right after World War II. You didn't question commands. You followed orders. That's the way things were. What was nice is that when I talked to, I had to track him down and find him and win his confidence. And not long before he died, which was like age 88, he told me that, look, Stan, I like what you're doing. If I remember anything else, I'll tell you about it. After all, what can they do to me now? Which was an interesting thought. You know, he's already 88.
And the point there, of course, the unspoken point is that these guys risk not only getting in trouble, but they're losing the retirement and everything else.
Yeah, veterans benefits, all that sort of thing. And there is an inherent patriotism that you don't see so much of today that goes with the World War II veterans. it was a world war that everybody agreed on. The Germans and Japanese were doing terrible things and so forth. Today, you know, after Vietnam, there were a lot of protests. There weren't many protests about World War II, not while it was going on. So I'm hopeful that we can get more witnesses to come forward. It takes a concentrated effort. And as a matter of fact, while here, I spoke with a local reporter who's been a writer for 15 years, not just newspapers, but does magazine articles. And after he started off quite negative, I gave him a hard time. And I think won him over that, yes, there is a story here about the government cover-up. Because I have maintained a number of times publicly that if any major press group would spend 10% of the effort that the Washington Post, say, put into the political Watergate, going after the cosmic Watergate, that it would take less than 6 months, starting with somebody like me. And I told him, there's a Pulitzer here. And it's easy to prove there's a cover-up, quoting government information. Not me, not I think, I believe, whatever. Here's what the facts show. Show the blacked out document, the white out documents that always get a laugh at my lectures, you know. I can't show them on radio because you can't see them over the microphone. But, and I'm kind of hopeful that I can get him sufficiently interested because I know that the solid story is there. The real problem, and it certainly doesn't apply to you, but is many of the people in the media take great pride in their knowledge of what's important in the world. The New York Times, the Washington Post, we're on top of it, you know. And everybody agrees. I've never heard anybody disagree with the notion that if flying saucers are real, that's a big story. Everybody agrees. The biggest story of the millennium, maybe two. However, these people who take such great pride in their knowledge figure that if this were true, they would know about it because they keep up with what's important in the world, and they don't, so it must not be true. And anybody who says it is must be some kind of a nut, and we're not going to waste our resources looking for something that can't possibly be there because if it was, we would already know about it.
You've got the media pretty well nailed there, Stanton Friedman. I think I've been in the media for 40 years now. I hate to tell my age, but they... You know, this ridiculing this is a thing because, hey, if it were real, we'd know by now. I mean, they're informed, but they're naive at the same time.
You know, isn't it interesting that the Iran-Contra scandal was broken by a Lebanese newspaper and not by the Washington Post, which is right in the backyard of where things were going on. So it's hard to move the media, and I've often said if they spent 10% of what they spent on such important stories as Monica Lewinsky and Elian Gonzalez and Gary Condit, remember him? They could blow the lid off. And the kicker here is that there's a step beyond that. What happens when the truth does come out? That depends, of course, what truth comes out. If it's like War of the Worlds, aliens are destroying Earth, you know, killing 50 people every day, that's very different from saying the planet's being visited, but they haven't destroyed anybody yet. You know, I mean, War of the Worlds, in other words, created panic, but you can understand the panic. I was in New Jersey in 1938. I mean, it was only four. I didn't hear the broadcast, but if you believed the broadcast, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, then you had a reason to panic. What could we do against Martians who were destroying New Jersey and killing people? You know. But if it's played straight, one of the things that would happen, and I think this is one of the key reasons for not revealing the truth, it's one thing to fear panic, and that depends on how you handle the story. But I think it would mean that an awful lot of people would push for an earthling orientation, as opposed to the nationalistic ones that we all have, Americans, Chinese, Greeks, Peruvians. If we start to think of ourselves as earthlings, then governments lose power. No government wants its citizens to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism's the only game in town, as far as I can see. So that's part of the story. Another part of the story is not only power on the part of government, but where do we go from here on this planet? I try to look at this planet as an alien would. I am not an alien. I mean, I live in Canada, but I'm not an alien. I'm a dual citizen. I think from their viewpoint, we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. I look around the world and, you know, I used to take great pride in, gee, when my kids grow up, it's going to be a heck of a lot better world than when I grew up. World War II.
Well, yeah, we all thought that, and it seems to me it's going the other direction.
Frankly, yes, I think it is. I don't think it is a better world. And one of the things that bothers me, and there are a lot, but I do a lot of checking on people who claim certain credentials. I call colleges. Did this person attend there? They can tell you that if you got a degree or whatever. They can't give you a grade point average, but you can find that out. And I almost invariably find that the person I'm asking about, and that's the reason I'm calling because I was suspicious in the first place, didn't attend there. And then I ask the person I'm talking to, typically the registrar's office, do you get a lot of calls about people claiming to have gone here who didn't go here?
Let me guess. The answer is no.
The answer is all the time we get
calls. Oh, God, I missed that. I missed completely.
Yeah, and the one of the saddest stories I heard, I called the Air Force Academy. It's a prestigious place, after all. And the person I was checking on had indeed not graduated from there, as I suspected. And she said, and then I asked her, you get calls about people claim to have gone there. She says, you know, we are prestigious. We get a lot of calls. People claim that they went here. She said, the saddest story, and this is people who hadn't gone there, about people who hadn't gone there. She said, the saddest story is a woman calls and says, her fiancé had attended there and had lost his diploma. And she thought it would be great if she could surprise him with a new diploma. Is that possible? Oh, yes, surely. Give me the information and we'll see. Turned out the guy had never attended there, and I'd sure like to know what the rest of that story was.
Yeah, I'd like to have been there when she was told, right?
Well, what I'm getting at here is I'm concerned about a lack of ethics, of morality. People won't seem to think there's anything wrong with lying about their credentials, lying about their background. That scares me. Will people do anything for greed? You know, Enron makes sense in that kind of a situation. So that is of concern to me.
I would think as a researcher that actually would be a concern, too. I mean, do you you've developed over the years some way to tell if a guy's really pulling your leg or not.
Well, I always try to check, though. And, well, last Monday, literally this past Monday, I was at the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas. And, of course, I've been championing the original Majestic 12 document.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I want to talk to you about that in a minute. Maybe you'll answer me right now.
Well, the biggest objection, there's a whole book by Kevin D. Randall called Case MJ-12, came out this year, January, in which he claims basically that there's nothing to the documents, they're all frauds. Now, one of his, he does his research by armchair theorizing, and in one particular way, one of the documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, says, briefing officer Admiral Roscoe H. Hillencoder, MJ-1. He said, that proves the documents are fraud because he was a vice admiral, not a full admiral, and he would never have called himself admiral. And the names of the members of the MJ-12 group, there are generic ranks for everybody. What I mean by generic ranks, you use the term general, whether it's brigadier, major, lieutenant, general. You use the term admiral, whether it's vice, rear, or full admiral. A standard practice, as it turns out, in many situations, you have a mix of civilians and, you know, because what rank does a civilian have compared to the military? Well, I was over there and dug out several examples of memos that had been written by President Eisenhower's staff secretary. By this time, he started off as a colonel. By this time, he was a brigadier general, Andrew Goodpaster. And he would sit on these top secret meetings, and he'd write a memo of the conference, memcons, they called them over there. I found a number of instances where he would list the attendees using generic ranks again, and maybe five military people, only one of whom was a four-star, including listing himself, General Goodpaster. The memo is signed A.J. Goodpaster, Brigadier General. So here we have an exact duplicate that is somebody calling himself by generic rank when he himself was a lower rank.
Yeah, good example.
Yeah, and so that proves that that is not a sufficient reason to throw out the documents. And there are a whole bunch of these kinds of things that people make claims about that when you go checking on them, it turn out not to be true. But they do their claiming sitting in their armchair instead of going to the archives. I've been to 20 archives. It takes work. You got to plow through it. And the Abilene, Kansas is not exactly in the middle of the world. You got to drive 3 hours to get there, you know, from Kansas City. But I get a little tired of people. I'll be talking about that tomorrow in my article about the tax on MJ-12. There was another one, Popular Mechanics. Did a cover story on Roswell. I love the way magazines do cover stories. Roswell, big, bold letters, you know, got to sell magazines, of course. They make noises about the people in Roswell just taking advantage of gullible people. The museum in Roswell, which has had 1.35 million visitors, is free. No admission charge there. The magazines aren't free, you know. Anyway, they had this June, this year, cover story, Roswell. The guy says, well, sorry, folks, but the bad news is Roswell didn't happen. What are the reasons? Well, it's now been shown that Frank Kaufman was a fraud, and he's been involved in this right from the start. What? I started the research in the mid-70s. No, Frank. The first book came out in 1980, The Roswell Incident, no Frank Kaufman. Bill Moore and I did five more papers by 1985, no Frank Kaufman. I started the Unsolved Mysteries Program in 1989, no Frank Kaufman. He came out of the woodwork from Kevin Randall again in 1991, and he says he's been involved from the start, and several of us have noted that there was no reason to believe anything Frank said for a variety of reasons. The second reason they said, oh, gee, too bad. They got the morning reports. Now, these are things that keep track of Colonel so-and-so was assigned here, the major has joined the outfit, just personnel transfers kind of thing. They were not classified. Why in the world would you find anything in there about the recovery of a crash flying saucer and alien bodies? It would certainly be top secret. You're not going to put it casually. Oh, yeah, found a saucer and three bodies.
And Colonel Saws went to launch.
Yeah, that kind of thing. The third thing is they said they had all, the military had, all this stuff was declassified. There were 11 boxes of stuff at the National Archives. And the trouble is, what the boxes had was the junk that the Air Force had put together for their big fat report. But there were no declassified documents about Roswell.
So none at all.
No. I wish I'd find them. I'd love it. There was another article in Skeptic magazine with the big word Roswell on the cover, trying to sell magazines. And they show a picture of a beautifully artistic saucer stuck in the ground, sleek, metallic, round, flock of sheep down below and military vehicles in the background. And the only crash they talk about is the one on the Brazel Ranch north of Roswell. All that was found there was debris, darn it. It's not an intact saucer. It's not half of an intact. Little pieces of stuff spread out over an area 3/4 of a mile long. You'd never know that from looking at that picture. The picture's totally irrelevant. He also tries to put the date of the first book at 1988, he says, when in fact it was 1980. And he buys the Air Force notion of saying that the story first came out in the National Enquirer when Jesse Marcel, Major Marcel, the intelligence officer at the base, came forward and claimed that he'd recovered wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. Well, the story was in 1980, and the date is significant. I gave the Enquirer reporter, a man named Bob Pratt, a very good reporter, whom I had met and who served as a liaison. The Enquirer had a five-man panel, four PhDs and a master's degree, to decide the best case for the previous year, and Bob was liaison with the panel. I had given him Jesse Marcel's name and address, because Bill Moore and I had finished our work on the book. Our first book came out that year, and we'd already talked to 62 people. So rather than tabloidizing the story, how else would the Inquirer get the story if Major Marcel didn't go to them? And they also have a line about me. Also in 1978, Stanton Friedman, a UFO researcher, can't say nuclear physicist, you understand, I met with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Well, this garbage gets repeated, and so I get a little irked at stuff like this that's put out with government labeling on it, the Air Force report. It's 1,000 pages long. We paid for printing that monstrosity, and it's got lies in it. And then the New York Times picks up on it. They did a 60-column-inch story. It was a pretty good-sized story for the New York Times. Front page, upper left-hand corner, Sunday Times in 1994. There's no better placement for a story in a newspaper in the United States because the newspapers are stacked, and that's what you see when you look at it. Not one comment from people involved in the story. They talk about Mogul balloons. And if he'd done any checking, he would see that nothing about it matched the story of what the witnesses says the wreckage looked like. And that's the New York Times. The original document was the Eisenhower briefing document. Attached to that was a Truman Forrestal memo authorizing Operation Majestic 12. And then we found the Cutler-Twining memo. Cutler was Ike's national security advisor. General Twining was a big wheel, and he wasn't quite yet chief of staff. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but he was head of the Air Force at this time. Okay, subsequent to that, there was another roll of film with the report for instructions on how do you handle crashed saucers and bodies, Special Operating Manual 1.01. And then after that, there was this whole bunch of documents received by a guy named Tim Cooper in Big Bear Lake, California. Well, I am satisfied that the Truman Forrestal memo, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Cutler-Twining memo are genuine. The SOM 101 Special Operating Manual, I'd say it was 80-20 likely that it is genuine. And then my work on the other documents says they're all phony. And some of them are what I call emulations. And I found the originals in books. Somebody retyped them, changed a few words, used an old typewriter, of course, scanned the handwritten information, three different pieces of data, for example, I approve July 9th, 1947, Harry Truman. Three different handwritten things on the night. You can put the emulation right on top of the reel, and those fit precisely. And they all have mistakes in them. And so once I got on to how these were done, I was able to find originals for seven, clear-cut, published in books, no question about it. And then as I looked at the others, I could see what they were doing, all kinds of phony documents. And I say, well, why would anybody do that? It's a lot of trouble. Well, it isn't if you do it the way I said. You retype, you scan, or Xerox, doesn't matter. And then you make it look old and dirty, you crinkle it, and, you know, looks good window dressing there. Well, the standard thing in the intelligence community, if good material gets out, you flood the market with garbage, including enough mistakes so that any smart person could show that it was garbage, and then you have that rub off on the genuine stuff. Well, this is garbage, so that must be garbage. Guilt by association. So it's unfortunate. It would be nice if these were all true, genuine, real, honest documents. But once I've had people look at, here's the original, here's the emulation, they recognize that the language is almost identical word for word, and there are incongruities. For example, there's a directive to General Wiedemeyer, he was a China expert, to go to China in July 1947. Now, the emulation is a directive to General Twining to go to New Mexico to look at a saucer. And the Wiedemeyer one, it says, when you're finished in China, go to Korea, which makes sense. Close to Japan right after the wars, 1947. In the emulation, it says, when you're finished in New Mexico, go to Sandia, Cindy is in New Mexico. Sorry, fellas. That's a goof.
Right. You're right. We're not saying Albuquerque.
Yeah. And there are, all of them have this kind of incongruities, if you will.
Well, let me ask you about the thing that's really come up in a lot of shows recently. It's about this story about President Eisenhower, instead of going to the dentist, goes out to Edwards Air Force Base and meets an alien.
Well, yeah, Bill Moore did a lot of checking on that story. The background is that he was staying out in Palm Springs, California, at some wealthy guy's house, and the press hadn't seen him for several hours. Now, the press is there to keep tabs on the president, and suddenly they were worried that maybe he had a heart attack. You know, what's going on here? Something serious may be happening. So they raised a fuss with his press secretary, Haggerty. Where's the president? Well, let me check. He's busy with something. The story that comes out then, oh, well, he was having dental work done. And, you know, kind of uncomfortable, and he doesn't want to talk to you guys right now. And everybody can understand that, especially back then. Now, Bill Moore did a lot of checking on that story many years later. He found the widow of the dentist. The dentist was named. She couldn't remember her husband ever working on the president. You'd think she would. I mean, it's not...
I agree with you.
Secondly, he found the list of thank you notes from the White House. Everybody loves to get a note signed by the president. You know, they make these up by the gross. Thanks for your help during our visit and stuff like that. There was no thank you note to the dentist. Third, they keep pretty good medical records on presidents. You know, when they go to the doctors and when they get shots and everything, little polyp removed, whatever. There's no mention of the medical records of dental work that day. Now, does that prove that Ike met with an alien? No, it does not. It means he could have met with an alien. And I should point out, in 1952, Ike was president-elect. The election was November 4th, 1952, when he became president January 20th, 1953. In that interim, he'd made a secret trip to Korea. Everybody thought he was staying at the Waldorf Astoria. They had people who came down and talked to the press, and they just talked with the president. He was working on this or that. He had been whisked away early in the morning, put on a plane, and made a secret flight to Korea. So
if we were court lawyers in a trial, we could say, hey, he's done this before.
Yeah. Yeah. There's precedent, in other words. And there's a whole book, Ike Spies, which makes quite clear that Ike was very much into intelligence work, into quiet work. He tried not to put stuff on paper. He personally approved every U-2 flight over the Soviet Union. He didn't delegate that to somebody else. He didn't design the airplane. I don't mean that. And then he took full responsibility. First, you know, they said that Gary Powers, U-2, had gone off course. Sorry, bad winds blowing in the wrong direction. The one that was shot down over the Soviet Union. And then finally, when Khrushchev said, hey, gotcha, we got the pilot, we got the craft, we got the camera, Ike stood up and said, because of the secrecy in the Soviet Union, we have to know what's going on because we are concerned about our national security. And I give him a lot of credit for, you know, coming forward. But what I'm saying is I can't prove that didn't happen. It is possible that it did happen. And I use that as an example when people say, well, how come they've never met with our officials? You know, the usual, why don't they land on the White House lawn kind of stuff. I say, how do you know they didn't? I do have a good story along those lines, though. Two different people have told me they saw official Air Force footage of a craft landing at Holloman Air Force Base.
In New Mexico.
Yeah, in April 1964. Aliens getting out, military people walking over, greeting them, and they all go off together. Two different people have said they've seen the official footage of that. And I said, well, you know, how do you know it wasn't a Disney kind of stand? We've seen that kind of footage. We've seen official footage. If I can get a third guy to tell me that, then I'll believe that that film exists, you know. So that would have been a contact, even if it wasn't with the president.
You've got to let us know when you find that third person.
Yeah, I would certainly do that. And, you know, once in a while you do get lucky, like when I was at the archives the other day. It didn't take me too long to get what I was looking for, partly because they're cooperative archivists over there. But you got to keep looking, and you have to have high visibility, programs like yours, so that people know who to contact. And within the last day, partly because I was on a big radio show last night, I have had several phone calls about people who have information for me that I'm dying to talk to find out what's new. And, you know, we want to get the data before the people die. My toll-free number, 877-457-0232. That's 877-457-0232. I have a live answering service when I'm not in. I answer my own phone, but I can't do that when I'm not home, and I don't have a cell phone. We'd like to hear from anybody who's got something to relate that could be of significance and where they're not so worried about, you know, what happened a lot of years ago. Maybe it's time to talk.
And, of course, we have it over on our website as well, a telephone number, Stanton's toll-free number, so you can call and then give him a tip.
I'd look forward to it. The more, the merrier.
Thank you very much, Stanton. I know you had some other things to do. It's been incredible. We could spend hours.
My pleasure indeed.
If you would like to write to Jerry Pippin, just address your letter to The Jerry Pippin Talk Show, P.O. Box 800, OK, Oklahoma. Jerry's the only talk show host that not only has an 800 telephone number, but he also has an 800 post office box. That's Jerry Pippin, P.O. Box 800, OK, OK, 74446. Or if you would like to send a fax to Jerry, his number is area code 918-683-2612.
Pleasure talking with Stanton Friedman, and our show is about over here for tonight, but we've had a lot of fun here at the first annual Crash Retrieval Conference at the Sunset Station in Las Vegas, talking with Stanton Friedman about MJ-12, of course the Wood Brothers, the promoters of this conference, they're experts in that field as well. I got a note here about Betty Hill. A lot of people have been asking about her. You know, she's been undergoing chemotherapy. Betty Hill, of course, of Barney and Betty Hill fame in the 60s, probably the first abduction case I know about. And her cancer is not a result of that at all. Later in life, Betty Hill actually went to Chernobyl and was exposed to radioactivity there. Quite a lady. And if you'd like, in fact, if you'd like to go over to our website and take a look at it at jerrypippin.com, you can see that we have the complete Betty Hill story, probably better than anybody, really, because we go into details about her life, not only about her UFO experience with the ETs and the abductions, but some of the other things that this phenomenal woman has been involved in. Anyway, Betty Hill is feeling better now. Her voice is strong. And we have an address over on our website. If you'd like to click on the Betty Hill section, you can write her a regular mail, a regular letter. She'd love to hear from you. She says she's received quite a few already. That's at jerrypippin.com. Want me to spell that? Yeah, it's all small letters, J-E-R-R-Y-P-I-P-P-I-N, P as in Paul, jerrypippin.com. Click on the little neon A in there, and you'll see a picture of Betty and Barney Hill, and click on there, and you can read all about her. I'd like to thank Larry Dickett, our executive producer, Nancy McKinney here in Las Vegas, producing the show, and yours truly, Jerry Pippin. Until next time, I'm saying... Well, of course, goodbye, but more than that, cheers.